jazz.
Busted.
Wow. Well, people, we go through hell and high water for you to get a podcast together, and sometimes the water's a little hellier than others. Anyway, welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 206. It's a three-man podcast now. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike, and sitting opposite me is one of the best birthday gifts I've ever received. It's really hard to describe, kids, but I'm going to try. A running joke on the podcast is, of course, my musical man crush on Brad Meldow. And Patrick somehow got a couple of images of Brad Meldow and had them photoshopped onto a small pillowcase, which fits over a small body pillow. One shows unhappy Brad, and the other shows happy Brad, or as I like to call them, mad slash sad Brad and glad Brad. This is like the coolest thing ever. And so right now, because of my thank you Skype for screwing us, because of my Skype difficulties, we have mad Brad on the other side of the table from me. But next time, perhaps when the sound goes well, we'll be glad Brad. Anyway. Pat sent me some other junk for my birthday, but, you know, fuck all that noise. I have a Brad Meldow pillow. This is so cool. It's like a prized possession. I swear to God, it's really cool.
I'm hoping Jen is not too jealous of it.
She's grateful because, you know, it means on those long, cold nights, I can just, you know, snuggle up with Brad instead of causing, difficulties. I've got Brad to keep me warm. So.
We all do in our hearts, don't we?
Yeah, he's such a warm guy, so it's nice to have a pillow of Brad Meldow. Now, the really fun thing would be to someday be able to see him live in concert and to bring the Brad pillow with me.
Show that to him.
And see if he would sign it. Because, what would you do? A middle-aged man presents you with a pillow with his face on two sides. Would you be like, oh, what a charming, tribute? Or would you be like, security.
Yeah, that's the second option is what he's going to go for. You're thinking years of therapy for Mr. Meldow if he sees that, but luckily he can afford it, so.
Yeah, so anyway, thanks so much. Really, really cool gift there. Very impressed with that. I don't know how I can ever come up with anything quite as good as that. You know, a blanket pillow fort made out of, pictures of Paul Desmond. I don't know. It would be really tough.
His bald and smiling visage everywhere. That sounds frightening. Yeah, I think my brother got my folks a giant blanket with photographs of the family imprinted on it. And I will tell you, that was horrific. So at least Brad's kind of a small, manageable size. If you don't like him, you can put him in a drawer. But I do not recommend blankets with family images on them. That's a step too far.
Yeah, because you sweat on them and stuff, and that can never be. You know, bodily fluids and family members is not a sentence we need to complete.
I was just thinking of the images themselves, but thank you for making that even more graphic. Anyway, tonight's episode, we're picking up and then going to put to bed the thread of the best albums of the 2010s. We did a four-episode arc on those. We took a little break and did some things from the second half of 2020. And some listeners came through with recommendations for us to look at, albums we had not yet covered. So shout out to them.
Thank you for all those cards and letters, you folks in television land.
Hugo recommended Craig Taborn's Daylight Ghosts, among other selections. And that was the one I chose because Mike Maneri gives me a rash and he was on some of the other selections. I'm not quite used to that violin yet. JD recommended Matthew Shipp's Piano Song and Daylight Ghost was ECM 2017. Shipp's Piano Song, Thirsty Ear. Mr. Shipp has had a long relationship with Thirsty Ear of 2016. And Eero or Iro, I'm not sure. This gentleman is from Finland. E-E-R-O is his first name. And he suggested Yusef Kamal's Black Focus from 2016 on Brownswood. And then Jared recommended Aaron Parks' Little Big, 2018 on a rope-a-dope. So all of these are from the second, or really the third of 2020. And I really appreciate people reaching out and giving us these suggestions. It's nice to hear from listeners. You know, we hear from, I'd say, about 0.5% of the listeners that we have. So it is, you know, appreciated when you reach out and give us suggestions. And, you know, I think this was an interesting lineup. Do you have a preference as to what we talk about first?
Nope, whatever you want.
Okay, well, to me, these kind of divided themselves into two groups. There was an in-group taking very different approaches to what I thought of as fairly accessible music, and then an out-group that took very different approaches to, you know, more challenging, more artsy music. Let's start out and move in. What do you think?
Sounds fine to me. Okay. Can I guess what the outs are and what the ins are?
You sure may.
I'm going to guess the outs are the piano guys, Craig Taborn and Matthew Shipp.
I would agree with that. Yeah, absolutely. So how about starting with the Ship piano song? He has a huge discography. He's played in other people's groups. He's done his own stuff. I have a couple of his recordings. Was he like in a major group with one of the later generation of avant-garde tenors?
Ivo Perlman, I think. I don't know if he's a bass player or a tenor player, but I think he's tenor. Isn't that right? I can't look anything up.
Okay, so. I would think so. I feel like, was there somebody else? Maybe I'm wrong. I feel like he was in some other important avant-garde players.
Yeah, Ivo Perlman is a Brazilian saxophonist, and mm-hmm. They have played together a shit ton. I think that's a fair way of putting it.
David S. Ware, that's it. He was in David S. Ware's group for a very long time. In fact, right. His discography with that group goes over 15 years and at least as many releases. So, yeah, that's who I was thinking of. I was not aware of Ivo, but yeah.
The reason I was thinking of Ivo is, so famously, when Ship recorded Piano Song, you know, he's telling people, this might be my last recording, you know, my last leader date. He's since put out, since 2016, class, he has since put out 32 more releases.
Oh, my God.
32, including a 7-disc Ship Perlman compilation. I mean, the guy's he just doesn't stop recording. I mean, he is.
Yes, I'm seeing it here on his
really
discography.
Prolific.
Leo, yes. Oh, yeah. With Perlman from 96 through 2018, he, oh my God, so many releases on Leo, 20 or so.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is a prolific guy. You know, I got an album of his 10, 12, 15 years ago, and I just didn't connect with it. This was marketed to me as, and I think it a fair description, is kind of beginnership as a way that, you know, if you were looking for the more accessible side of the man, this final recording by him, ha ha ha. Well, you know, I heard final recording, and then some people said his final recording for Thirsty Ear.
And so I don't, whatever. Yeah.
You know, which is a different thing, right? You know, that's like, okay, well.
He said famously in interviews, this may well be my final recording. He didn't put in parentheses of Thirsty Ear.
Okay. Yeah,
and
yeah.
You know, and apparently when he said that, you know, I mean, I'm not here to pour scorn on Matthew Shipp at all. It's just, you know, when he said that, some people said, well, at least he'll still continue performing live. Well, he's not just performing live. The guy is, you know, he is prolific as a sideman. He's continuing to record as a leader and as a sideman. So there's no slowing down.
He just
can't stop.
And there are artists like this, you know, people that, you know, we talked about Lee Konitz. I recently realized I might be getting close to having everything Gary Burton did on ACM, which is a hell of a lot.
Yeah.
And one thing about some of these recordings, I mean, some of them don't even make the reference books because he was very prolific. And now it's like, well, he's retired. I think he really is done recording. And at that point, you can say, okay, well, this is now finite. You know, we're done here. So there's not another one coming down the pike in 6 months. So now I feel like there's breathing room to go and look this up and see if I like X or Y, you know, in this case from 30 years ago or whatever. But there can be a sense of being kind of overwhelmed by artists where it's like, well, there's just more music than I can process. I mean, it was sort of Blue Note's problem in the classic years where they didn't release albums because they just couldn't put out that many. I mean, there just wasn't a market for as many records as they recorded. And now, of course, there is because classic Blue Notes ain't being made no more, right? You know, the 60s and the 50s are over and Blue Note's still not going concern, but that era is done. And so we're willing to go listen to, like, you know, those obscure, unreleased Wayne Shorter joints that, you know, have a lot of value to them, but at the time, no one would have had ears to hear. It just not enough time in the day. So yeah, Ship is like somebody that maybe in 30 years when I'm long gone, somebody can sit down and say, okay, this is what Ship did, and start working through it without the sense of, oh my God, I'll never catch up, you know. But as it is, it's like, man, this dude is relentless.
Oh, I have the same problem you have in that I have literally one other CD by this guy. And I have a pile of the David Ware stuff, so I know him from that context. But that's going back, you know, to the 80s and 90s. That's a long time ago. And I do feel, if only on the strength of this, it's like, well, shit, you know, here's a voice that I need to know more about, you know. And fortunately, yeah. there's a lot available.
Yeah, you won't have to.
I will. Yeah, it's not going to be hard to find him. But yeah, I just, you know, I knew of him, and I did not realize his discography was quite so monumental. And like I said, I'm familiar with him from the David Ware
right.
Content.
Yeah, you're much more of a Ware dude than I am, and you know a lot more about Ware. Yeah, well, it is an interesting question, you know, for an artist. I mean, every artist knows at some level that they aren't going to be here forever, and that in some ways, if they leave recordings behind, that's the way that, you know, people in the future are going to reach them. They're not going to be able to see them live. There might be YouTube videos or something, but, you know, that's what is not recorded will be lost. So, you know, you have to ask yourself, do you want to make, if you can, one record a year? Do you want to make two? Do you want to make five? You want to make one record every 5 years? Are you looking for that perfect expression? You only want to record yourself when you think you've really got something startling to do? Or do you want to keep documenting yourself because you never know when inspiration's going to hit? And at some point, the road is going to end. Yeah, there's not an answer to it. It's a fascinating question. I mean, some artists, either from their own choice or because they just didn't get opportunities, very scant discographies, and then others, very, very prolific ones. And I think especially in the last 10, 15, 20, 30 years when jazz is kind of sundered from the marketplace, right? It's really a hobby music. So it's not a big record executive deciding, should we put another record by this artist out this year or next year or the next 3 years? It's up to the artist. If you want to record yourself, you can. So what do you do? At least if you're of a certain level. Well, anyway, about Piano Song, what do you think of this particular release?
Yeah, so a couple of immediate thoughts. My natural, where I gravitated as a frame of reference, and Ship may not like this in the least, would be a player like Cedar Walton, who is both in and out. And I felt like Ship kind of fit into that bag just a little bit, but, you know, that is just the first hot take based on not having spent a lot of time thinking about this guy in a trio setting. I'm just going to be flat out honest. So he reminds me a little bit of Cedar Walton, the player who can get out, but also sort of kind of in the same song, have enough hook, have enough, not really melody here, is there? It's more sort of rhythmic conception, especially in his soloing. It's more rhythmic than anything else to my ear. So I kind of thought of him in kind of the same constellation that I tend to think of Cedar Walton. Having said all that, I thought, I recognize why you want to include this as out. I didn't think this was that far out. I think when the pace picks up on certain numbers, it can feel farther out. Gravity Point would be a good example. where it almost feels like Ship and the drummer, Newman Taylor Baker, are in competition at certain points. But in general, I didn't think this got that far.
Just comparatively. I mean, you know,
a couple of these
sessions are very in. And then,
this isn't hooky in the least. Let's put it that way. There are no hooks here. You're not going to finish this album and afterwards go, yeah, I want to hum Flying Carpet. There's some cool songs here, but, you know, I'll be damned if I could hum anything like a melody from any of them. I don't think of Ship as a melodic player on this basis. And I actually don't think of him that much as a melodic player back in the David Ware days either. That was kind of a boiler room for Ware to, you know, wail over. And it seemed less, the function of the rhythm section in those quartets was less to limn the melody than it was to kind of give Ware a foundation to do kind of what he does. This is not about that at all. This is more about letting these three players stretch and interact. I wanted to ask you about the recording. Were you happy with it? I'm a little unhappy with it. What I mean by that is, of course, it's, you know, mastered. It sounds wonderful. It's just that it's an echoey sound. It's kind of a wet sound. That includes the drums. And I was a little surprised by that, maybe. I'm used to it's sort of trios being a little drier sounding than this.
Okay.
And I didn't quite know what to make of that. It may just be that I have shitty headphones, you know, in my current setup and I'm not able to hear everything the way I want to, but I wasn't able to hear Michael Bisio's bass with quite the same clarity. Also, there's a couple of drum solos and I just didn't need them. nothing against Newman Taylor Baker. He's a fine drummer. It's just, I'm just not interested in the trio setting and hearing any kind of extended drum solo for the most part. I don't know. So this I thought this was really good, but it's spiky, it's thorny, it's not super accessible in the sense that it's not going to curl up in your lap. This is a kind of, you know, this is a high fiber trio recording. You know, a lot of brand here, I think, and it demands careful engagement, careful listening. It's not background music at all. And when I tune into it, I like it. But like I said, I could do with a couple less drum solos. There's a longish one on Cosmopolitan, and I forget where the other one was that kind of got under my teeth a little bit. Yeah, on the basis of this, I want to hear more Matthew Shipp, and I actually do want to hear him with Ivo Perlman to kind of get a sense of what that sounds like. Because
I'm going to guess abrasive, but
yeah, I'm going to guess abrasive too. But to me, it felt like the chief interplay here was between Shipp and Baker, and it was like dueling percussionists almost at some points, which I didn't mind. I thought that was interesting, but it's hard to grok a little bit for me. I'm still working on it. I like this, but it was of the four, the least, it's the one that grabbed me the least, I'll be honest. I don't think it's any less worthy than the other three, but this one for me was hard to kind of curl up with. I don't know. Did you like it better than I did or what?
Well, it's, you know, the player, and I don't know Cedar Walton's playing that well. I mean, the player that he reminded me of at times on this recording was Andrew Hill.
Yeah, I could hear that. I could see it. But Hill does more melodically and harmonically than Shipp does, don't you think?
Right, yeah, he's right, exactly. It's really more a couple of the early tunes. And you do get to hear the bass on Cosmopolitan, but I agree that most of the time. And the other thing was I did not have a lot of opportunity to listen to this album loudly. You know, I'm sharing an office, can't really crank it, haven't had a lot of time at home. It was a very odd week. I spent most of it sick. So, you know, I think this was, of the four of them, the one that suffered the most from that.
Mm.
But, yeah, you know, I'd say that somewhat on a Silence of those broken rhythms remind me of Andrew Hill to some degree.
Mm, interesting.
But, yeah, I mean, Hill is probably a little bit more poised. I mean, I think of ship largely is out. And this is an album that has been characterized to me by our listeners, and I just think other places I read is kind of introductory ship. So here he's more balancing between the out and the in than I think he does in other recordings. Hmm. But that tendency, I think, is probably still he's more towards the atonal than Hill, who was never atonal. He was more oblique. And then again, the most striking thing about his playing to me is it's kind of slithery and not rhythmically centered the way most jazz piano playing or most jazz playing is, right? It's kind of these awkward, you know, 5 or 8 or 11 over, you know, 4 rhythms, and they're not simple meter. So we did some of that. It felt a little bit like a portfolio album, which I know is ridiculous to say about somebody well into his career, so far into it that he was at least threatening to finish the recorded part of it. But it was kind of, you know, it didn't seem to be about one thing, but about things that Matthew can do. I did feel like there was some move towards accessibility, partially because most of these performances are kind of between 4 and 6 minutes long.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't epic, unrolling, roiling energy fests that just went on 10, 12 minutes. They were kind of shorter units. And, you know, one of the, you know, like, there's one that has kind of a little percussion hook at the beginning or whatever. That's too probably stronger term. It's not melodic or whistleable, but it's, you know, like a little motif that you kind of remember. Oh, this is that song with the auxiliary percussion of the start kind of thing. So, yeah, it didn't knock me out. Of course, the first one, I've not found a point where I kind of get something Ship's doing and say, man, I need more of that. I like that. It's reaching me. He's obviously a very serious player and a hugely prolific one, obviously the left wing of the music. But yeah, this album I did find more accessible and had more points of reference for me than some of the other things I've heard by him. But it wasn't the one that, you know, quote unquote, sold me and said, okay, I got to get some Ship now. Got to get my Ship together, you know.
Right. The closest thing to a hook I found here is the song Microwave, which almost sounds like a kind of addled march, you know. Dun, 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 dun. It's kind of got a repeated motif throughout, but then in the middle, they take out, it almost goes outside for a while. But yeah, that's, you know, my take on this is I want to hear more of this guy, and I really want to hear him again with a horn player. It makes me want to go back, and I'd like to hear the Ivo Perlman recordings. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And then, you know, compare that to the earlier Ware stuff, of which I have an abundance, and see what I make of him in those terms. That might be interesting.
So yeah, learning experience for both of us. I mean, this is a guy that I was almost shocked when this gentleman brought it up. It's like, you know, you're right. We've never done a single Matthew Ship album. And it's kind of a little shocking. I mean, you tend to be better about bringing the avant-garde music to the podcast than I am. And it's just not something you've pursued him with in groups, but not him as a leader.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I got to admit it's not that I can't listen to the music or get nothing from that music, but you know, it's just not something I'm necessarily going to be seeking out a lot. And if I've got to put my avant-garde big boy pants on, I might say, well, I'm just going to listen to Cecil or Cecil Taylor or whatever. You know, just kind of somebody I know that, if nothing else, will amaze me. You know, just somebody who just kind of pins me to the wall. So, yeah, I, you know, liked it. I would agree that this is probably a good way to get to know him and that it's not quite so in your face. And he does kind of show you a lot of his different wares. You know, it's not just about one thing that he can do. And don't worry, people, he's still recording. So he's still around. It's okay. Well, if you don't have other thoughts, we can move on to the other headliner who at one point, and maybe we'll do this, you talked about maybe doing an episode on Craig and some of his influences.
Yeah, there's an article about Taborn did a solo concert. I think it was a solo concert. And he was listening to he talked about in the article, I think it was a New York Times Magazine article. And he talked about he had been listening to three things in particular. before that concert. And I thought it would be really cool to listen to the three things and then the album of that concert.
It's like Avenging Angel, maybe. Is I know that's one of his solo.
Yeah, something like that. And one of the things he was listening to, I think, was a Keith Jarrett album. And then I think there might have been some Bach in there somewhere and then something else. So, you know, it would be interesting to do. Well, that's a project for another time. We'll get to it eventually.
It was the Go-Go's, I'm pretty sure.
The Go-Go's.
Beauty and the Beat, yeah.
Yeah, Plots. Yeah, there you go.
So, anyway, Craig Taborn, this is a quartet album on ECM. And I will admit, you know, Hugo gave us several recommendations. And this one, I just felt like, okay, this is a little bit more accessible. Daylight Ghosts from 2017. There's enough spine to it on just a very short listen that I'm not going to completely get into the what I call the modern ECM mire, where I just feel like it's so gray. I just want to pass out. So Taborn on piano, Chris Speed, tenor and clarinet, Chris Lightcap on drums. And I had a typo there, so it looks like it's Christ Lightcap, which would be a pretty cool name for a drummer, but I think it's Chris.
That's got to be bass, actually. Chris Lightcap.
No, you're right. Absolutely. I'm sorry, I missed it because it's Dave King, he of the Bad Plus, on the drums.
Yeah.
And that was an encouraging thing because I think, yeah, probably every ECM release at this point needs Dave King on it just to keep it honest.
I'm so glad you said that. I was going to say that. That was actually, well, I was going to say exactly that, but, you know, having him here kicks up the energy a notch. Although apparently Taborn's been killing it on ECM for a while now. His ECM stuff is highly regarded and, you know, not as, you know, it's not Norwegian Keening and the Mist stuff. Apparently he's kind of supposedly the ECM recordings have given him a certain kind of discipline and energy that one doesn't normally associate with the ECM label. So that's kind of interesting to hear
these
about.
These eras, and he is more in the thick middle of his career.
Yeah.
And, yeah, you know, I saw him, I think I talked about it at the Chicago Jazz Fest a couple years back when we still had gatherings of multiple people. And that particular concert, you know, he was like in the maybe kind of the offside tent or something, and it was a little bit obsessive. He just kind of kept, he seemed to get into a corner and stay there. So it was not my favorite by him. I certainly like this recording better. I'm interested in pursuing more of what he does. He was a important part of Chris Potter albums, and really contributed strongly to those. So yeah, I mean, ECM, I've recently kind of obsessively started collecting 70s ECM. I love finding clean copies of LPs and they sound wonderful, but that's a very different story from 2010s ECM.
Right.
Which, you know, not that all, there's a lot of dreamy crap on in the 70s, no question, but it seems like it's getting more and more in that direction and less mixing in other elements. This has some electronic tinges to it, though I wouldn't think of it as a very electronic album. What do you think of Daylight Ghosts?
Yeah, the first thing to say is Taborn has got quite a rep among I've read a little bit, not for this podcast, but I can't remember where I ran across this. Not just in I read this in some other context. Can't remember where I read it, but he's kind of a player's player. You know how they talk about writers.
Right.
The kind of person that other writers go, more people should know this guy because, man, he's really good or she's really good. Taborn is a kind of, he has that kind of rep among players where he's, you know, people rave about him, but he's not nearly as well known maybe as some of the other luminaries in the music. But you hear people talk about him and they all have, you know, great praise for him. And I remember I saw a televised interview with him. And I can't remember where I saw this. But he's just dead interesting, very thoughtful, considered guy. I do like this. Some of it, I think, has to do with Chris Speed. I think I've heard him on a couple other recordings. I don't have anything where he's the leader, as far as I know. But I've heard him on some other recordings, and I like him here a lot. And I especially like it when he busts out the clarinet on Jamaican Farewell.
Thank you.
a Roscoe Mitchell tune.
Which is not very Jamaican, but...
No, it's not.
Could use a little reggae on this, I gotta admit.
It's by Roscoe Mitchell, I mean, for God's sake. Who is someone that Taborn has gigged with? Taborn's played with Roscoe Mitchell, so it's probably where he ended up in his book.
Yeah, I was bitching about the reggae on Hudson, and now I'm like, no, I'm ready for some reggae. Never mind. Okay, just bring it on. Didn't happen.
Well, I would have thought you would have liked Jamaican Farewell because it's very meditative and calm with some really cool clarinet stuff going on.
It's a good
on.
Texture. I do appreciate that. Again, in general, in ECM albums, I'm like, anything with a little, I mean, meditative you're going to get. I mean, I guess that's just taken for granted. So I'm always hoping for a little surprise in terms of energy. But yeah, it was well done. I do like that clarinet texture. It's great. Yeah.
It was an interesting contrast with Ship, because I feel like Taborn is a more melodic player, not on every song, but on several songs. He and Speed will double the melody from time to time before then they take the tune out for a spin. I always find that kind of interesting. There's I don't want to say there's a template or a pattern. There are some songs that sort of begin quiet and kind of build, which I always kind of dig. But that's not the standard move here. It's not like every song is quiet. Yeah. Build, outro. There's a fair number of, you know, change of pace kinds of things here. And then some things never really blow up, right? So Reminder is kind of a slow burn all the way through on a, you know, it's a really slow burn. It's not a slow burn, a really low burn throughout. But I think Taborn's a little more, he feels more in here than Ship did on that album. And I feel like there are some melodies here and some kind of textures they're probably present in the Ship recording, but they seem more accessible to me in this recording. This felt like a more accessible.
Yeah, I mean, recording. it's artsier. I maybe out or just atonal. It's not even the right language to talk about. It's more that it's challenging rhythms. The melodies aren't always hummable. It's more oblique. But yeah, this is not some kind of freak out, you know, Albert Eiler style or something, you know, by no means. It's just that it's on the artsier spectrum. It's not trying to kind of, you know, the other two albums that we're going to look at in a minute here after I've had my chocolate are, more trying in their own ways to reach, I think, a broader audience and to have some kind of landing for people who aren't really that into jazz. I can't imagine somebody who is not into improvised music and art music knowing what the fuck to make of this. You know, I don't think there's a lot of on-ramps for the average listener here. Maybe more than in the Ship. But neither of these artists seems particularly interested in broadening their audience. It's for true believers.
Yeah.
But I mean, that doesn't mean it's not good. I mean, I'm a true believer.
The other thing I would say about Taborn, and I found this, I've listened to a couple other recordings, not just the Potter stuff, but I have a couple of recordings by him. He's just, I find him, and maybe this is, I'm influenced by the interview I saw. He's a deeply serious guy. He's a deeply serious player. And there's a kind serious, not without the kind of crabby Brad Meldow seriousness, but just, you know, serious. The album isn't playful. It's not a playful album. It's a meditative, thoughtful, engaged album. The other song I like a lot here is The Great Silence, which is the other big clarinet feature. And it's a good example of how, you know, Taborn's programming kind of works, because it's another long meditative, not long. And everything's here like 5 to 8 minutes long, but it's, you know, a 6 minute song, which is, you know, about textures, and the piano is doing accents really behind percussion and this sort of sinuous clarinet melody, if you like. And that's a kind of change of pace from New Glory, which comes before, which is a shorter number, which kind of builds and is a, you know, piano feature for the most part. And then Ancient is like a longer number, which follows, which is a slow crescendo feature for the piano, right? So he's got this kind of, you know, change of pace mojo going on throughout, which keeps you on your toes and keeps you attentive, I think. And again, I just feel like I can wrap my head around some of the melodies here more. None of this is exactly hummable, but this feels more accessible. It feels like there are more entry points on an early listen, which isn't to say that it's any less complicated or any less serious than Matthew Shipp's album, just a little more embraceable on a first listen.
Right. I mean, he's a different part on the spectrum. I mean, Tabor, I think is more, I mean, just like, you know, how often does ECM, it's not unknown, but they don't tend to put out, you know, Thirsty Ear is just a further left label than ECM, and ECM it can be pretty challenging, but it's not quite that audience. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the electronics, and they're not used heavily, but I think the main thing about them when he goes to keyboard or the bass player goes to electric bass or whatever is that they are used as melodic instruments linearly. They're not about textures or effects, you know, the way that it's just interesting how some albums seem acoustic, quote unquote, or electric. And really, I think we're talking more about how the instruments are used to some degree.
Yeah.
At least how electrical instruments are used. Because, I mean, you know, jazz guitar is electric, but until you get to that generation of Metheny, Schofield, Frizzell, it really is a pure kind of tone. And the main advantage is it's a different sound from the acoustic. You've got more sustain, and it can be louder, so you can be heard in a jazz group. But they don't treat it as a special effects machine that a Jimi Hendrix would or a... Van Halen, you know, it's just a linear voice. And here that's largely, you know, they're not in here for special effects, certainly.
I think another way of putting the accessibility issue is just to talk about the fact that, I did look this up, both albums got reviewed by, of all things, Pitchfork. That's how you know you've crossed over, when your jazz album, which is kind of outside, gets a review
Pitchfork. You know, to be honest, the thing is that Pitchfork writers get old, and then they all of a sudden think jazz is pretty cool. I think that's the whole story of Pitchfork. A lot of these guys are middle-aged now. Yeah.
They rate on a 10-point scale, and Shipp is 7.2. I think that's low, and Taborn is 8.2. Yeah. I feel like that's the accessibility factor right there.
Well, or at least...
1-point bump. You know?
At least the... No, I mean, both these guys, and Taborn's a bit, I think, younger than Shipp. I have not looked up their birth dates, but they are in you know, musical circles, people that follow this stuff, pretty well-known names, pretty established, you know, and both taken very... I mean, they got serious reputations. They aren't dilettantes. They aren't populists. You know, they are... serious artists who've been really committed to the music for a while, and you know, those people are going to get covered. They're both on, relatively by standards of jazz, established labels. You know, ECM certainly, for God's sake, but Thirsty Ear too. It's not a cute boutique label with 10 releases. It's you know, an ongoing concern for a while. Again, this was not the one that kind of, I think of the two, I like this better, but it was pretty elusive at times. And you know, I think that the saving grace was with Speed there and with King there, and I'm not trying to bag on the bassist. I mean, I think he was fine. It's just he wasn't allowed to shine as much, and, you know, maybe wasn't as much in charge of goosing things, but it kept it from settling into too much Nordic navel-gazing, which sometimes you get on that label. Well, in the second half of the show, we are going to talk about two much more populist approaches to the problem of putting out a jazz album in the 2010s. Do you want to start with Yusuf Kamal? Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Yusuf Kamal.
So, Yusuf, yes. I'm not a very good typist. So this is a group I found out that was comprised largely of two people, Kamal Williams on keyboards and Yusuf Days on drums. And they really only made one album.
Yeah.
And then kind of, I guess something happened with the drummer. Maybe he got in trouble in America. This Black Focus from 2016 was the album. And that was kind of the end of that particular group, though Kamal Williams has continued to pursue music. I'm not sure what exactly has happened to Yousef. This is, you know, a group out of England. On this particular album, there are several guest appearances. The name that I recognized right away was Shabaka Hutchings. We've talked about his work in his various groups. He's a sax and bass clarinet player. Yeah, this is, I don't know what, you know, it's supposedly based in, among other sources, in kind of English dance crazes. They'll say from grime. It's like, okay, I don't know all these subgenres of electronic music. I just don't. I'm not going to pretend I do. I'm a middle-aged man. But keyboards, drums are the bed, and then things are added on top of it. Did you like Black Focus? What do you think of it?
Yeah, let me just rattle off the names again real fast. Yousef Days is the drummer, percussionist. Kamal Williams, you mentioned him, piano and synth. And then Shabaka Hutchings on sax. Yelfries Valdez on trumpet. And then a couple different bass players, one of whom I assume is related to Yousef. Tom Dreisler and Kareem Days. And then on guitar, from time to time, Mansur Brown. Yeah, I like this a hell of a lot. I thought this was great. I really enjoyed this. I thought this is the kind of stuff that people like Glasper and even Kamasi Washington are grasping towards. And I kind of like how this was pulled off. So, you know, the synths and the percussion are there to create a kind of groove. They're the kind of bedrock over which you get your jazz content. The groove itself is not particularly jazzy. It's not that neither one of these guys can play jazz, but they come from different worlds, and that doesn't seem to be their primary focus. But you bring in the players, especially Hutchings and Valdez, to solo over this stuff, and man, you got something. I like this just a whole bunch. And sometimes I play a game with myself. What would Miles have done if he could live forever, you know? And I felt like I could see Miles doing shit like this, you know? I could see Miles in the 2020s listening to House and Trap and going, yeah, yeah, I'm gonna play with those guys. Yeah, I like this just a whole bunch. I don't think that it is as, how do I want to put this? I don't think it's as kind of, I feel like when I listen to Craig Taborn and Matthew Shipp, I feel like my jazz, I'm getting more jazz nourishment, as it were. But this is just so much more instantly accessible to me that I feel like it has less nutritional content, but it tastes better, at least on the first taste. You know, I feel like it's that makes it sound like this is like the Count Chocula of jazz. And that's not what I'm saying. I think there's more content here than that.
Oh, but it's more. In fact, I want an album called The Count Chocula of Jazz. It could be copyrighted.
I think Thundercat is the Count Chocula of jazz.
That's right.
Anyway. Yeah. I just, when I heard this, I was like, oh, I'm in a happy place. This just works for me. I really enjoyed this. I love the album length. It's not too long. I'm always happy when albums they have a certain kind of range that's not crazy long. And this is like jazz I could imagine people dancing to. I'm not clever enough to dance to this, but yeah, I just like this. It's not all burners. Some of it's kind of, you know, the title cut is actually kind of mellow and you've got some real shortcuts.
The energy that emanates from the two of you, the energy, and it's almost a yin yang situation. Yousef has always been energetic and energetic and deeply focused. And you see that in the music and it comes out. Kamal, on the other hand, is almost, yeah, yet it's just like a drop of stone and it just rippled endlessly.
And then you've got some stuff that's a little more aggressive, a little more out there, which isn't to say any of this is out. None of it is out. I think it's all squarely in, but it's just real accessible. I love listening to Hutchings and Valdez riff over this stuff. And, you know, the vocal stuff doesn't bother me. I wondered if it got on your nerves, but it didn't get on my nerves at all. What did you make of it? Did you like it? Or was this just like, nope, this is just too much like weird English pop music?
There you go. Yeah, I did like it. I think you described it really well. It interested me because this and the Parks are both working with certain kinds of pop structures, but they are different. Whereas this is more about one or two chords and is very much a bed of groove over which, as you say, sometimes it's just about establishing and continuing in a hypnotic fashion the groove. And sometimes, yeah, you get an instrument in there that's going to elaborate and play some jazz. But I feel like the gravity of it is always the groove is first, and then the soloing is what kind of happens as a topping to the groove. And the nice thing is if you are a more general interest listener, you can just ignore that.
Yep.
And if you're a jazz bow, you can kind of cock an ear and say what Hutchings is up to, or the trumpet player, you know, you could say, gets a nice rip off on, Strings of Light. Yeah, that's one where he really gets to kind of be featured.
Right.
You know, there are instances here where you get electronics as sound effects, textures, as opposed to Taborn, where he's just very seriously using them as another musical voice, but it's not, you know, going to kind of indulge himself and just kind of decorating the music. He's going to use it to express a line. And at one point, I think it's the end of Lowrider, I guess, where it just kind of, it breaks down into these textures and kind of sound effects, and there's some humor in it. So it's just kind of having fun with that. Now, that said, there's also some guitar improv on Lowrider, and I like it, but I think your ear is taught to treat it as decoration. And it's not, that doesn't mean it's not good and not enjoyable. I do enjoy it. And this is a very, you know, this is the kind of record I can put on while I'm working, and it keeps you going. And there is something to that kind of, if it's a good groove, I mean, it's not easy to make a good groove, but if you can do it, which these guys clearly can, you know, there's something to be said for that. It's got its own value to it. You know, it's not developmental. It's not necessarily going somewhere as much as kind of existing for a period of time and then ending. But, you know, I liked it. I thought it was neat. And it's certainly one direction you can take as a way of trying to bring new listeners into the fold is to do stuff that's kind of related to, I don't know, dance or electronic music, and just kind of sneak in some improvisation, right? And say, okay, you're kind of familiar with this. How about a little of that? What do you think of that? Did it give you a headache? Are you okay with it? And just go from there. So, yeah, I liked it. I mean, I don't feel like my mind was just fucking blown. But, it was, I think, successful in what it was trying to do. You know, I think it worked on its own terms. I certainly wouldn't want to listen to nothing but this. But, yeah, it as a product, I liked it. Yeah, you know, it's a little hard for me, I guess, qualitatively to say. I don't know, other than it seemed like these were pretty good grooves. You know, you have to kind of be a connoisseur to say, oh, that person's really good at laying it down. That one's so-so, you know, because it's kind of, ultimately, I think this is judged on really how good is the drummer and how soothing or just hypnotic is a keyboard player. And that's what people are looking for, not can these guys really, you know, quote unquote, solo. But it was cool. And I never heard of them. And I thought it was going to be something else. I mean, there's some spoken word on this.
Yeah.
I guess, you mentioned vocals. And to me, it's like, well, there isn't like somebody singing. It's like, come put some butter on my back. It's just, you know, these kind of clips or spoken word bits, which, okay. All right. Wow. Thank you for asking me about my antivirus right in the middle of this. yeah, I just love it. Computers suck. They really do. So anyway, yeah, Yusef Kamal's Black Focus, and basically that's all they wrote for the most part, but the musicians continue to make music in this idiom. So our last suggestion was Aaron Parks's Little Big. That was not a reference to the running time. It's all of 80 minutes.
Yeah.
It's a long in. And Aaron's a piano and keyboard player. Greg Tuhey, and I'm sorry, Greg, I'm sure I just mispronounced your name, on guitar. David Ginyard, bass. Tommy Crane on drums. This is another album that I feel like is much more aimed and much easier to digest. And I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm not trying to condescend and say, I like this. I enjoyed it. But it is trying to be accessible. It's not trying to be super artsy for the most part. There's a couple exceptions. Very different approach, though. It's instrumental. It's somewhat groove-oriented, but I think it works in a different way. What do you think of Big Little or Little Big or whatever it is? Which one is it? Little Big.
I think the move people are going to say is that this is fusion. I don't think it's fusion. I think this is a rock album. It has jazz content, but I feel like this is a rock album.
And which rock band is it like? Who does it remind you of?
Well, that's a really good question. The quick and dirty answer is always say Steely Dan. I don't know. Who do you think it's like?
For me, the chord progressions, a couple of them seem directly lifted from Radiohead. I mean, just...
Yes, well, I was I would agree with that. I think this is a rock album masquerading as a jazz album, and apparently he's had some success with this because the follow-up is apparently even got better. You know, there's a second Little Big 2.
Okay,
has got even bigger ratings. The star here is Tui on guitar. He's from New Zealand by way of Berklee School of Music. The only other thing I'm aware of him in a jazz context is with Jerome Sabah on No Filter from the same year, actually. Jerome Sabah, okay. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but he's a saxophonist.
Sax player.
Yeah. And they've got an album together called No Filter, which on the strength of this, I will look for. Yeah, I think this is a rock album. I just think this is a flat out rock album. I think it's really successful. The two soloists obviously are Parks and Tui. They trade, they take turns, and there's enough improvisational content here to keep jazz players, to keep jazz heads happy. But, you know, this is what, all 4/4, 7/8, you know, what are the time signatures here? It's all pretty damn accessible stuff. And like you said, if you've been listening to Radiohead, you're ready for this. And grooves, hooks aplenty. My ears immediately connected to this. I thought this was easy for me to access and tap my feet to. I enjoyed the hell out of it. I thought it was really interesting. Again, same comment here that I had with Yusuf Kamal. I don't think this is more challenging and maybe more difficult is the wrong word, but you know, Tayborn and Ship are much more challenging than this. They're thorny and they're difficult. They're intellectually forbidding in some ways. This, you first listen, you'll be like, oh, okay, I know what this is. I've got this. You know, I can listen along with this. I just found it really accessible, but I think that's a little deceptive because I think what they're doing is, you know, fairly complex. These kind of building rhythms and grooves over which, you know, Parks and Tui solo, basically. I liked it. I thought it was hooky and interesting. And first listen, I just was like, oh, yeah, I'm in the bag with this. And I will absolutely look up to find more Aaron Parks stuff. You know, like I said, real accessible, kind of an earworm for me. I don't think it's intellectually challenging. It's not as demanding as the other stuff, as Tayborn and Ship. Which isn't to say it's worse. It's just different. It's just not as demanding in certain ways. It for listeners like us, schooled on a certain era of rock,
this is just right in our oral wheelhouse. We don't have to stretch very far at all to get this, I think. So for that reason, you know, I kind of liked it. I don't know. I hope you liked it. I assume you did.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that very first song gets you in this groove. And my theory is, what's the difference between this and Black Focus? And it's like 1 to 2 chords extra, right? I mean, Black Focus is very much about a groove that stays in place, that goes on and on and on, where this is about little cycles of chords. Not quite psychedelic music, which is one of my favorite kinds, you know, where you're just riffing on maybe 3 chords like Blue Oyster Cult would, and the whole point is kind of getting into a trance, but not hugely removed. And again, you know, like the very beginning of Siren, for instance. It's just, that's exit music for a film. You know, those are those chord changes. It's not, I mean, it's kind of a paraphrase of that Radiohead song. And there are other little spots. And I'm not trying, you know, obviously this is not a Radiohead covers album. This is not, but it's that world, that harmonic language. And it is hugely familiar to certain middle-aged white guys. And yeah, I liked it. And I think it was very pleasant listening. I'd say that you don't hear a lot necessarily from Parks the improviser. It's not that he never plays, but I feel like an awful lot of what he's doing is setting up grooves and, you know, melodies and just kind of atmosphere more than just, you know, that's not necessarily a criticism. I don't know that he was trying to feature himself as a soloist a lot, but it's just you're not going to find out about Aaron Parks burning a finger man in this. You know, I think Professor Strange Weather, which is also the best name on the album, that was one tune where I felt like, oh, they're getting a little more challenging here. They're going a little bit out. Digital Society at 7 minutes, a little bit more ambitious, a little bit more structured, more sections. But, you know, the album that I kind of thought about a little bit was Todd Sickafuse's Tiny Resistors, which is somewhat using some of this harmonic language, but I tend to think of that as being a work of brilliance, or for me, genius. I mean, it's accessible, but it goes through more changes. There's more ideas in it. It's a little stranger. I think it's a little bit more, it feels more heartfelt to me, where this is none of those things, but still very good, very likable. I mean, you know, Hearth, I felt a little bit of Keith Jarrett slipping in, maybe. I mean, just a little bit of his most accessible grooving stuff. Not technically, maybe, but that sound. And then I felt like it kind of ended with a whimper. I mean, you know, if you're going to go 80 minutes, that last 5 minutes probably ought to be pretty ecstatic. And it was kind of like, well, we're done here. I was like, yeah, didn't quite put a period on it the way I would have liked. But yeah, it's a cool record. And if you're looking for something you can just kind of groove along to and work to, or just enjoy, and it's got something intelligent for you if you listen to it, but you can also just enjoy it kind of middle of the mind. It fits that bill beautifully. So, and I never heard of the guy, and I think it's cool stuff. And I can imagine, you know, especially if you're coming to this music fairly recently, and again, more from the rock side, you know, if your doorway into jazz is rock, probably Parks. If it's dance music or electronic music, so-called, probably Black Focus. You know, it's just a different, slightly different vocabulary, different goals. But I liked it.
Good, good, good.
Blah, 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 blah. Yeah.
Wednesday morning at 5 o'clock, as the day begins, silently closing her bedroom door, leaving the note
So we've kind of hurried along through these selections in part because we've had some technical difficulties. Do you have on your mind any kind of pop matters?
Well, for my birthday, someone sent me the complete RCA albums of Harry Nilsson. So I'd only known Nilsson through a couple of the obvious albums, including Newman, Nilsson Sings Newman, Nilsson Schmilsson, a couple of different greatest hits comps. So I've only just listened to the first two albums of this, Pandemonium Shadow Show and Aerial Ballet, both of which are 60s confections at the time when he was getting high with all of the members of the Beatles on different occasions. My initial reaction is two things. One, golly, he really borrows from, steals, elaborates on Lennon-McCartney a bunch. There's a lot of homage being paid, and deliberately in some cases, like he's knowingly invoking them on some songs. But my God, what a singer. I mean, holy shit, he is simply amazing. And a much better writer, I guess, now that I've had a chance to kind of just dig into a couple of albums. The first two of these albums are both, you basically get mono and stereo versions on the CDs, which is kind of interesting.
Oh, okay.
And he is a vocal technician of, man, he's extremely good. I mean, there's a guy who is really, really in control of his instrument. The song that probably he's best known for, the song that he's most famous for, might be Everybody's Talking from Midnight Cowboy, the film. It's a song that he didn't write. And just listen to that song again carefully sometime and listen to what his voice can do moment to moment. You know, the stereo recording is just glorious. It sounds amazing. But he does these sort of vocal fills between choruses that you kind of go, wow, that's the kind of thing Roy Orbison would do if he could do, except he can't do. I'm not talking about range here. I'm just talking about melodic conception. I mean, he could have, you know, he does record an album of jazz standards, and obviously he could have been a jazz singer if he wanted to be. He's that gifted. I think he's, I knew from reading about him, he was a great rock vocalist, but, having a chance to kind of dig in deep on just a couple of albums, I'm kind of flabbergasted at how consistently amazing he is. Now, I'm interested to listen to what happens later when the drugs and the alcohol take hold.
That's right.
That'll be,
when things get hairy for Nilsson, yes.
When things get hairy for Nilsson, it'll be kind of interesting. He's got, there's a cool song that you should listen to, tell me what you think of when you get a chance, called Good Old Desk, which is actually about God. Get it? Good Old Desk. Give that a listen and see what you think. And then there's, he's obsessed with dad. He's obsessed with childhood. So those are things that come up all the time on his songs. Those are like his touchstones. So yeah, give it a listen. Tell me what you think at some point. Of the first two albums, I think I prefer Aerial Ballet, but my God, just listening to the guy's voice is a real pleasure. He's just an amazing, amazing singer. I can't say enough about how good his voice is, and the things he can do with it are uncanny.
Okay.
So yeah, give him a listen when you get a chance.
Uh-oh.
And thanks for the gift. It was much appreciated.
Yeah, so, if you're enjoying an album, you turn over the Happy Brad pillow, and then if it's not so good, flip him over to Sad Brad.
Sad Brad. Mad Brad.
Well, I'll tell you, it was not hard finding a picture of Brad being sad, but finding one of Brad smiling was a real chore. There are too many of those
Mad
out there.
Brad's glad.
Yeah, there's not a lot of glad Brad.
Well, I think I mentioned former partner and I had a yin yang poster on the wall with a black and red fish. And we used to wake up and I would say, are you the red fish or the black fish today?
Right.
Which fish are you? Red, I think, was bad and black was good. So now it's mad and sad Brad.
which Brad are you?
Are you glad Brad or mad Brad? Which one are you? Yeah.
All we want to do is just be some kind of Brad.
Some
So, yeah, I've got very little. I did listen to a recent EP that was dropped by one of the review services, Gianna Lauren's Vanity Metrics, a short little EP. It's indie as fuck. She sounds quite a bit like Cat Power, and also something about her voice reminded me, and I went back to listen to Cherry Glazer, the great album Apocalyptic.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a fun little record. So, you know, I enjoyed it. I Vanity Metrics, it struck me as it has more as I've aged. Is it, you know, the indie scene is how many people in it, you know, can barely conventionally quote unquote sing, right? You know, it's just like the instrument they've been dealt with by life, and perhaps also just the attitude of what authenticity means and what expression means. You know, they are not quite singing at all. You know, it's kind of squeezing notes out. And it's like, okay, well, you know, as I get older, I probably appreciate this less, or maybe I'm just more attuned to the technical side of it. That doesn't mean I don't appreciate a singer who's expressive and got things to say who is not necessarily opera level, but just, you know, I kind of noticed, like, man, you barely can do this, can't you? I mean, it's kind of cool, but wow, this is a real effort for you to hit these notes. So, you know, just a neat little thing. I feel guilty. I just, there's a lot of music I've not been able to get to recently. I hope to be listening to more interesting things soon, but yeah, that's something if you're curious about, if you like that sort of thing, you might like Vanity Metrics. For those who like Cat Power, for those who've maybe you want a 10% of Cherry Glazer on top of Cat Power. That's something to look up.
Day after day, alone on a hill, the man with the foolish grin is keeping perfectly still. But nobody wants to know him. They can see that he's just
I should have mentioned also, because it'll give you a thrill, recently gave the album The Singles by Shirley Bassey another spin.
Lord.
And for those who don't know, you'll know who Shirley Bassey is if you've watched any James Bond. She sings the theme song to Goldfinger, most memorably. And then, of course, people forget, she also does Diamonds Are Forever, an underrated James Bond film, if only for Shirley Bassey's song. Anyway, on the singles, there are a few Beatles covers. And how do I want to put this? She should not do Beatles covers. Shirley Bassey has an amazing voice, but she does not have Harry Nilsson's Lennon McCartney-friendly voice. So when she sings The Fool on the Hill, it's
Fool on the Hill.
It's more like The Fool on the Shrill. She also does Something. Which
Something to Something.
I don't know. I mean, I think the worst part is when she gets everything is done with like a big band in a orchestra hall kind of accompaniment. I don't know if you remember this. When she gets to the part of the song where it's, you know, I don't know. It's like, I don't know. You know, it's just with this huge orchestra behind her. I mean, Shirley Bassey didn't really need a microphone.
But she also covers like Light My Fire. I don't know if that's on that.
Yes.
And that's just, it's great. It's like, take this, Jim Morrison, right in the nads.
I think that's really good, actually.
It is, exactly.
So anyway, there's a couple of songs that are right in her wheelhouse. So like the Beatles are not in her wheelhouse. So, you know, Something, Fool on the Hill, not a good idea. But Big Spender, oh my God, great song.
She'll make a meal of that, yeah.
Hey, Big Spender. I mean, it's just, oh my God. And then there's a couple of songs that she sings that I realized Scott Walker sings in the same era, which is really funny to think
Why
about.
Why couldn't they do duets? Because that would make the world end.
So her version of If You Go Away is just, I mean, it's like the anti-Scott Walker version. Scott Walker's version is sort of like David Bowie haunted. And her version is like, you know, she's screaming at the guy, if you go away, if you go away. And I think they also both do No Regrets.
Except for the listener. The listener is the one with the regrets. Everyone else is fine.
Anyway, I love Shirley Bassey. She's a special, for the kids who don't know, you know, this is a 60s chanteuse who, she's in this weird nebulous zone that a lot of singers were in, who kind of came up really doing, what would you call, not cabaret isn't quite right, Fondal. But you know.
Well, it's, you know, just kind of, she is so campy that the most heterosexual, straight-laced dude in the world listening to her kind of wants to get into drag. You know, it's just
there's something, right. Yeah. And she does pop songs. She does pop songs. Right, yeah. Right.
But it's just, you know, something, it's like, so over the top about what she's doing that she still takes with enough seriousness. It's not a parody. It just sort of is, even without trying. Yeah.
There's no quit in Shirley Bassey. Shirley Bassey is just going to give her all to every one of these songs. And it's like
the indomitable Shirley Bassey.
Right. And it's just like, my God, you know, something is not the song you do that with, you know?
Yeah. Well-known belter George Harrison. Yeah.
Yeah. She ends with "What Kind of Fool Am I?" which is the kind of thing that Sammy Davis Jr. made a meal out of. And you're like, right. This is what Shirley Bassey should be singing. This kind of big, you know.
Right. I mean,
showstopper.
You don't want to do an album by those two because you would just die.
I know. Your head would explode. So anyway, for those who don't know Shirley Bassey, she's this great. She's English, isn't she?
Yes.
Yeah. She's just a wonderful, big-voiced, brassy singer. She's England's answer to Ethel Merman, if Ethel Merman was singing pop tunes in the 60s.
Yeah, and that was really a question that no one wanted to answer, but there she is.
So anyway, I've been listening to her again, and with much pleasure, much guilty pleasure. So, you know, if you play this loudly with other people around, they look at you like, what is wrong with you?
You're just trying to say thank you.
Right? I just don't understand why you would be listening to this. You know, it's like, my mom is like, I don't listen to this. Why are you listening to this?
Right, exactly. It's a little bit old for me. Well, the other amazing thing about her is that she is, you know, you hear that voice and you think this is the whitest voice on earth, but she's black. So it's just,
yes.
You wouldn't have guessed that. But so yeah, that's Pop Matters. And next time is holiday time, right?
It's our Christmas episode.
All right.
Our annual Christmas episode.
Something to look forward to, listeners. Jazz Mastered. Oh boy, I'm no Shirley Bassey. This concludes episode 206 of the Jazz Mastered podcast, and not a minute too soon. As always, you can download us from www.jazzmastered.com, from Apple Podcasts, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud. You can stream it at All About Jazz. You can reach me by dropping me a line on Facebook, by looking me up on All About Jazz, or emailing pat@jazzmastered.com. You can email mike@jazzbastard.com, but if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, did it really fall at all? As Mike mentioned, tune in next time. We're going to do our Christmas special. It's really a Christmas special. Sorry, it's not a holiday. It's all Christian stuff or really secular capitalist stuff. We're going to do works by Dave Brubeck, Mel Torme, Oscar Peterson, Lauren Henderson, and Warren Wolf. So till next time, take care.
Well, class, now that Pat has left the room for his usual milking of the prostate, I would like to share with you a little composition that I call Peas, with apologies to Joyce and Joyce Kilmer. I think that Pat will never be happier than when he goes to pee. A pee, Pat feels, is always best when his water flows without rest. A pee that cascades is God's way to lift Pat's mood at end of day. A pee that arcs strong through air mocks the stern proctologist's care, shows middle-aged Pat free of pain, and his urinal is safe to rain. Poems are made by fools like me, but only Pat can take a pee. I'll be here all week.
So did you do a poetry reading?
Maybe.
It's not like you're going to hide it from me. I'm the one editing the fucking audio. So your little riffs in the most recent episode with some backing music is pretty groovy.
Oh, really? You put it in the last one?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure my listeners will enjoy it.
Well, I hope they like this one.
But now their taste is whetted. Now they're going to become insatiable.
Whetted is the right word. Did you hear it?
Not today. No, I mean, I just got back.
Oh, I see. Well, whetted is the right word.
Okay. Can't wait to edit that, sucker.